Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:16 p.m. That is Pacific Summer Time, and today is Friday the 13th of April. And of course it's Friday, so it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought I'd start off today with this very long-term chart of the Dow Jones. It goes all the way back to 1900. And something that immediately jumps out, of course, is that it tends to go sideways for a long time, then it goes up for a long time, and then goes sideways again. There is lateral resistance at 100, 1000, 10,000. So in previous secular bull markets, the Dow Jones has gone up by 10 times. Of course, it's a lot easier to go up 10 times from 100 to 1,000 than it is to go from 10,000 to 100,000. You'll remember that there was a book published back in the early 2000s, which was Dow 100,000. So the prognostication that the index could reach a six-figure number is certainly not a new one. But there is, to coin a phrase, there is a long way from here to there. And the bigger question right now is whether we're going to see more of a correction in the short term or whether this very impressive medium-term bull market that's been going on since 2008 is maturing or if not ending. But the reason that I start off by showing this very long-term chart is because we know that the stock market tends to move in long-term cycles. And that when it spends a long time doing nothing, then it also tends to go up for a long time subsequently. Even when we look back at 1987, where the stock market pulled back in a very violent manner, then it was very short term in nature, and the index subsequently went up by an additional five times shortly after the low. So that's, I think, rather impressive that we, even after what was considered an incredibly tumultuous period of time, the index was still able to outperform over the long term. And what that tells us is that there are very powerful forces that can drive a secular bull market. Well, we know what the powerful forces that drove the secular bull market were in the 1990s. It was the internet. It was the TMT bubble, so telecoms, technology, and media. And I think most importantly, it was mobile phones and the evolution of the internet. Well, what is it that's driving the bull market now? Well, certainly those big pieces of technology that were developed in the 1990s are in a mature phase now, where you have the evolution of companies like Amazon and Google, Facebook, and these are completely new companies that now occupy significant weightings within the major indices, but didn't exist in the 1990s to any great extent within those indices. So that is certainly helping to drive the market higher. But then you have an accelerating pace of technological innovation. If we go back and think about what was it in the early 1980s that was driving the market higher, well, it was that inflation had been conquered, and that interest rates were starting to come down, that the Dow Jones had been trading under a glass ceiling at 1,000 for the better part of 15 years, and then it was able to break out as interest rates started to come down. Well, we have had an environment where interest rates have come down an awful lot between the lows that we saw in 2008 and now. And we're at a point where interest rates are starting to go back up again because inflationary pressures are starting to rise. Well, inflation is certainly not good news for the bond markets, but it's not great news for investors either. And the only way that investors can protect themselves against an inflationary environment is either to buy inflation hedges like gold, or to buy shares that have the ability, that have pricing power, or the ability to raise their dividends well in excess of the rate of inflation. And when we think about it in those terms, it is rather interesting, because What I think is quite interesting right now is, for example, if we look at some of the large tobacco shares, these are companies that sell an addictive substance and they are trending lower. Well, they have some of the most reliable dividends in the world. They're about as defensive gets in terms of cash flows. And the yield is starting to rise here. It's up to 4.94% on the estimated yield. It had been down in the low threes back in 2016. Well, what this is beginning to price in is that interest rates are going to rise and that highly defensive shares are going to have a more competitive yield in order to be competitive, well, in order to survive in that kind of competitive environment. So, when we look at the 10-year treasury, it's at 2.8%, and it has been consolidating below this 3% level now for much of this year so far. It had really rather raced to get up to that level, so some consolidation is not at all, I think, surprising. But it is worth just looking at the long-term chart, because what we have right now looks different, that it trended lower for an awfully long time from the peak in the early 1980s, really until the low in 2016. But it's been ranging really between the 1.4% level and 3% for the last 7 years. And that's a sufficiently long range that we might start to be thinking about base formation completion. And I think it is one of the most likely developments that we're going to see at some point this year is that bond yields break on the upside. That is something that I think looks increasingly likely. When we look at TIPS yields, then we're presented with a similar condition. The yield has been in this lengthy ranging phase for 5 years already. It's testing the upper side of that range. There is some consolidation going on, but it looks more likely than not that we're going to see it breaking on the upside. When we look at the continuous commodity index, well, it trended lower for a pretty prolonged period, all the way from 2011 until the early part of 2016, and it's been largely range bound since then. So it is now firming from the region of the trend mean, and this is an unweighted index, so it's not just oil, but it's also the precious metals. It's the other energy and industrial metal contracts, and then of course you have the agriculturals. Well, winter wheat isn't looking particularly favorable at the present time, and that is helping to put some interest back into wheat contracts. What I find particularly interesting is, despite the fact that you've had quite a bit of volatility in terms of the pops on the upside, that within the range since the middle of 2016, you have a progression of higher reaction lows. So what that suggests is that we may still have a surfeit of supply above the market, but that there is accumulation underway, and that is something that will eventually contribute to a sustained breakout. So we have the conditions for inflationary pressures to start to come back in. Then when we look at the perhaps the one figure that is difficult for central banks to hedonic out, it is wage growth. And there's an upward bias. What I published during the week was some data from epsilon theory that highlighted that one of the reasons why this had not broken out was because of the fact that the number of hours worked had not or had contracted ever so slightly in February. If it had simply remained the same, then wage growth would have been above 3%. And that reliance on some very narrow ways of calculating wage growth is something that we cannot simply continue to rely on to contain inflationary pressures. everybody can see that the cost of living is increasing, that certainly it is, we're seeing the purchasing power of fiat currencies deteriorating. And then, of course, when we look at the gold price, it has got this very narrow range in the region of the upper side of what is already a 5-year base formation. It continues to firm from the region of the trend mean. It looks almost inevitable that this is going to break on the upside. So, when we think about it in those terms, there is the realistic possibility that inflationary pressures are going to start to come back in here. Now, if we go back and turn our attention back to the stock market, then if we look at, for example, the Dow Jones, and particularly over the last decade, I think we have evidence of the three psychological perception stages of a bull market. Because in the early part of the trend taking off from early 2009, nobody really believed it was possible. And it was very much a trading environment, and people were taking their profits early. They didn't trust it. They were certainly not going to be caught by another down leg. So when people had profits, they were taking them. But as quantitative easing came and went, and then came back in again, and then came back in again, people started to get the message that the Fed was going to backstop the stock market. So there was an acceptance phase. And that particularly was evident between about 2013 and 2015. Well, with the we had a taper tantrum in 2013, and because the Fed pulled back from that, we had a very persistent advance in stocks. But then the Fed tapered its it finally did taper the quantitative easing, and the stock market had a couple of wobbles, and that was also a time when high yield spreads had been moving higher. And I think it is worth just taking a quick look at that particular chart, because it was in 2014 that they started to break higher, and they were already trending higher by 2015, and that did contribute to quite a bit of volatility on the stock market. What is particularly interesting right now is that they're completely inert. That's despite the fact that we are in more of a corrective phase on the stock market right now. But then if we return to the 10-year chart, we can see that there was a particularly consistent trend from the beginning of 2016, and it really took off after the presidential election at the end of 2016. And it did accelerate. And we define acceleration as a trend ending, but of undetermined duration. We then had this massive reaction against the prevailing trend, and it very rapidly closed to the overextension relative to the trend mean, and then retested the low in the last couple of weeks, and we've subsequently had a bounce. So now, I think a lot of people are going to be asking a very important question, and that is, whether are the lows going to hold? Well, so far they're holding. If they hold, and knowing what we do know about a type 2 massive reaction against the prevailing trend, it's quite likely that we get a period of ranging subsequently. Because people tend to ask simple questions, and it's what's really changed? And they will be casting around for reasons, but not a great deal has changed. What initiated the big pullback was the short VIX trading strategy going bust because volatility picked up. And that contributed to a loss of complacency in the market that stocks could only rise. Subsequently, we've had geopolitical tensions rising, and certainly the market is now paying more attention to what President Trump is doing, although certainly they haven't paid much attention to what he was doing all the way through 2017. And when we think about it in those terms, we know that there are issues that are evolving in terms of geopolitical tensions. But that's not new news. It certainly hasn't just become a factor in 2018. These are factors that have been brewing now for a couple of years already. But they do deserve mention, because it is, I think, part of the reason why we're getting a changing environment. And The question that's outstanding is how it's going to affect the various different asset classes. Because we have had a rise in populism, which is variously described as populism or racism, xenophobia, or I think a desire for independence. Well, that's all a can we can just lump all of that into this revolt against the status quo. And we're seeing it evident in a significant number of countries. And it's not just in the USA, it's in the UK, it's in France and Germany and Italy, and most recently this week it was evident in Hungary. Well, all of this is a reflection of the fact that we've had both globalization and technological innovation that have had disinflationary forces. They have been very positive for net growth in the global economy. But I think it is worth highlighting that that net growth has been lumpy, that it has been better for some regions than others. And if we think about the confidence with which, for example, Europe and the USA were able to agree to remove farm subsidies back in the late 1990s and early 2000s, and that really then handed over the global agricultural market to places like Brazil, which was able to massively increase its supply of various commodities, not least, for example, sugar. Well, they were that was almost part that was part of the fact that the status quo was growing in power, and that the sugar market was not considered to be particularly important, and it was considered to be uncompetitive, and that it would be much better to have lower cost producers prosper in the emerging markets. But it's only a small that was a relatively small employer, but heavy industry has done the same, car manufacturing has done the same, and this has denuded large parts of the industrial bases of the OECD of their industries, and all those industries have moved to places like Brazil and China and India and a significant number of other emerging markets. Well, that has contributed to the long-term unemployment, the failure of a significant number of these communities, but the problem in a democracy is that these people vote, and they are now finding voice in these populist trends, and they will keep voting for change until they get what they want, and mostly what they want is more money. And the fact that in the USA right now that you have a fiscal stimulus at a point where we have full employment and low I think or high capacity utilization, that is a direct result of this desire for more money. That people are asking the question, what about me? And the answer is here, have some more money. Well, that represents I think an outright inflationary pressure. The fact that gold has been ranging below its peak for the last few months and has been so very steady within that range is a reflection of the fact that inflationary pressures are rising, that government bond yields have been very steady below the 3% level, and it looks increasingly likely that they will break upwards. Well, again, that is likely to represent an issue, because we know that that there has been a liquidity fueled bull market, and the quantity of money outstanding on central bank balance sheets is in the order of $20.7 trillion. And that's still a lot of money, and it has at least paused in its advance. It's going to be difficult for those central banks to remove that stimulus, but the Federal Reserve is already engaged in that, and the ECB is in the process of tapering. But the challenges that Europe has, and that the reason behind the ECB's final admittance that it would have to engage in quantitative easing have not been solved. In fact, they have simply been swept under the carpet by the fact that you have had an environment where there is simply no agreement on what the future of the EU is likely to be. And so far, the pace of reform is very slow because there's nobody wants to reopen the treaties, considering that they require ratification in every single country. So there was an imperfect solution was put in place, and it is an awful lot of work to try and improve it. Well, eventually it's going to have to get solved one way or the other. One of the reasons why Europe has been underperforming is because this is a very thorny issue. And when the ECB eventually does complete its taper, which is probably going to be in September, well, there's a strong likelihood that we're going to see government bond yields starting to rise. Well, Germany has prospered more than any other country from the EU, and as recently as 2016, investors were paying it to take their money. But the yield is currently at a half of 1%, and this represents the upper side of the underlying trading range on the region of the trend mean. So I think it's unlikely that we're going to see the yield contract very much from here. Then when we look at Italian yields, they're at 1.79%. That is a significantly lower yield than you have for US Treasuries. And it is a testament to just how profound the ECB's monetary intervention has been, that Italy can fund itself at such incredibly accommodative levels. But take the labels off the chart, and what we're presented with is a type 2 bottom with right-hand extension characteristics. And it does look like that these are about as low as the yields are going to go. And if this is as low as they're going to go, well, then the only place they have to go is up. And what that suggests is that there are massive outstanding questions with regard to Europe, and they are probably going to be reopened again later this year. That is also part of the reason why, if we just zoom in on, for example, the DAX index, that while Wall Street is trading above its trend mean, Europe is trading below it. And Europe has got some of the clearest patterns of underperformance, that not only did they underperform on the upside, but they are now also underperforming on the downside. And they are now at a critical juncture. Even the best performing indices are now testing the region of their respective trend means, and they are going to have to bounce from here and sustain moves back above them to confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. What that suggests is that in terms of the global beauty contest, that Europe is in the elimination zone. And then this is, I think, a very important point, because when people look at the high valuations that you have on Wall Street, then you look at the historically high PE ratios or cyclically adjusted PEs, then people are tend to go around and start looking for value. Well, Europe doesn't represent as much value as it could do because of these outstanding questions with regard to governance. Governance is just not improving. And if that is indeed the case, then an additional risk premium has to be put on the market. Of course, the other major region where governance is not improving is China. And again, this is another index that is trading below its trend mean. GDP growth alone does not translate into stock market performance. If it did, the Chinese market would be the best performing market in the world. You need improving governance. You need improving standards of governance, which I define as respect for minority shareholder interests, and then an independent judiciary so that you have recourse to enforce those minority shareholder interests, and you needed an independent or a free press so that the excesses of power can be challenged by the population. China has none of those. But it has had incredible economic growth, And what that has translated to is into an incredibly volatile stock market. It is now right in the region of its lows, and so far it has not really bounced. It is going to have to do more than that to really convince investors that this is an attractive proposition. I've posted a video and an article in here today about the subjugation of a what is essentially a parody app, and the number of people that have been out tooting their horns on Chang'an Avenue in Beijing, which leads down to Tiananmen Square, and they really are exhibiting youthful exuberance, and they all think it's a big joke. They are at a very real risk of coming under the full opprobrium of the communist regime, which is investing massively in a campaign to combat the freedom of association. So there are this is I think a very taut situation that is completely underappreciated by the investment community, or at least the chattering classes. But when we look at the price chart, this does not look like a particularly consistent trend, and I think that really does stand out. Now, the H share index in Hong Kong is right in the region of its trend mean, and it has pulled back violently from that 14,000 level, and so far it has continued to hold the region of the trend mean, but it absolutely needs to hold it. And that region there, around 11,750, is a rather key level for the index overall. It is trading at reasonably accommodative valuations, where you've got single-digit multiples and you've got a yield that is reasonably competitive globally. But nonetheless, I do believe that the Chinese market deserves an additional risk premium. Then, when we look at India, we've had a significant bounce from the region of the trend mean. I continue to think that we're in for some pause and consolidation, that it isn't simply going to rally straight back up and onto new high ground, but rather that we are going to get some additional ranging. But the more important point is that it is exhibiting relative strength, and we can argue that India does have improving standards of governance. And that's an important differentiator. If, in fact, if we go back and look at history over the course of the last 30 odd years, then India has outperformed from the perspective of a stock market investor. That it certainly hasn't performed in terms of its economic potential. It might yet do, but in terms of the stock market value that has been accumulated by the various indices, it has outperformed. So I think that is a testament to the fact that improving standards of governance do translate into shareholder value. Now, when we look at Vietnam, it has done spectacularly well over the last few years, but it is working on a downside Q reversal in here this week. So the potential is that it is going to unwind that overbought condition relative to the trend mean, and that suggests that we would have to be prepared for a 20% pullback. The important point is that it had got all the way back up to the peak that it had seen in early 2007. So this is a natural area where we can anticipate some pause in consolidation. In fact, if you go back and think about the Nasdaq 100, it did pretty much the same thing. It got all the way back up to the peak in 2000, and then we moved into a volatile ranging phase before it eventually broke higher and then really went on a rip-tearing, rip-roaring, I should say, bull market up to 7,000. And again, this is another index which has lost momentum. And we had a big pullback in February. It was a massive reaction against the prevailing trend. We got all the way up to a new high, and then that failed with a downside Q reversal, where the index moved to a new high and closed below the low of the previous week, the previous day. Then it followed through in the downside 4 days later. So now the very big question is the extent to which the lows are going to hold. The Nasdaq has put in a higher reaction low, and it has bounced from the region of the trend mean. But considering just how consistent that advance was from 2016 and the degree of euphoria that we saw in the market, then when we think about the medium-term bull market, I think it is very important to characterize or to spend a little bit of time to think about the endlessly fractal nature of markets. Because the very first chart we looked at was the Dow Jones, and the fact that it has tended to go up by 10 times every time it's had a significant bull market. Well, if one was only to think about that, then one would simply have bought back in 2013 when it was breaking out and wouldn't come back for another 30 years. But when we think about what happens in between, then the reality is that we get medium-term bull markets within secular bull markets, and we can get a number of those because secular bull markets tend to be punctuated by recessions. We know what the fears are going to be during the next recession because we have had this massive fiscal stimulus, and eventually it's going to have to be paid for. So that is something that is going to weigh on markets eventually. Now, when we have this very persistent and consistent advance in the stock market over the last couple of years, and then we get a more volatile ranging phase, well, we have an example of what that looked like back in 2014 and 2015 and through to the middle of 2016. It isn't at all unusual that markets can go sideways in a volatile ranging manner for anything from 6 to 18 months. And so far, we are really only about 2 months into this ranging phase. And it is, I think you would have to be very brave indeed to conclude that the lows are in. But so far, they have held. And as long as they are holding, then I think people are going to be willing to give the benefit of the doubt to higher to lateral ranging. But we know what the challenges are, that because we have higher geopolitical tensions, there are, I think, two very big considerations. One is what everyone's talking about, and it is trade wars between the USA and China. And that is a significant issue because China, just like Japan and South Korea, and indeed the USA, when it was evolving during the Industrial Revolution, has been flouting intellectual property rights and has been engaging in industrial espionage. That is exactly, for example, what the USA did by going to the UK and getting the plans for various knitting machines. So when we update it, China is obviously larger, we are further along, and they have engaged on a policy of corporate espionage or industrial espionage that is literally unprecedented in history. So we're now starting to get some, I think, feedback from that. The USA is at a point where it sees China as a competitor, and China has, in fact, said that it views the USA as a competitor. So that is going to contribute to the, I think, increasing competition. If we are indeed in a multipolar world, then China has every intention of becoming the center of gravity for Asia. And that is a, I think, a challenge to the USA's global hegemon characteristics. That's the first thing that people are thinking about. Everyone is already thinking about that. But then you also have the reality that China owns an awful lot of the USA's debt. And the USA's debt to GDP ratio is deteriorating. The quantity of outstanding debt is increasing, and the ability to service it has deteriorated since they've just cut taxes. And if you're the holder of that debt, it's you people have got to be reasonably worried about being able to enforce it. And that's why when you have the I guess when you have the reserve currency, you also need to have the largest military, because nobody is going to be able to enforce their claims as creditors on the USA without having an awfully large military presence. But it doesn't mean they have to keep buying them. And when we look at the total return on U.S. Treasury futures, they have top formation characteristics. It is looking increasingly likely that that top is going to be completed at some point in the next year. And that will signal the end of one of the greatest bull markets in history. But it will also completely change the global status quo. And that is the risk in stocks as well as in bond markets, that there will be a period of time that will require some getting used to the new environment, that the status quo that has benefited emerging markets, particularly from from globalization and technological innovation, could well end. And that would throw even greater emphasis back onto technological innovation. That is when you get automated factories opening up in the OECD. That is also where countries like China double down on automated factories to increase their competitive advantage. It's also where people really start to invest in energy, because if you strip out labor costs, the next really big cost for industry is energy. So we're seeing a great deal of innovation in the battery chemistry sector, and the energy intensity of batteries doubles about every 5.4 years. So it's a lot slower than semiconductors. But we've already had a lot of progress, and there are a number of competing battery architectures. So, for example, that aluminium-based batteries tend to be very heavy, but they have got great power density, so they'll be much more appropriate for power stations. The innovation that's going into developing batteries for locomotion is going to concentrate more on the chemistry, so that they'll be using instead of 111, which would be, and I apologize if I'm going to get this wrong because I don't have it in front of me, but it is basically a 1-to-1-to-1 ratio of nickel to manganese to cobalt. They want to push that out by the end of the next decade to 8-to-1-to-1, which would be nickel, manganese, cobalt. That would reduce the quantity of cobalt in the battery from 30% to 10%, and it would also contribute to a great deal of additional benefit in terms of the energy density. So we're not there yet, and it's going to take about a decade to get there. But the fact of the matter is that if we're getting a change in the evolving situation, that we're already starting to see that there is a change of leadership in the stock market. It's being driven by technology companies that have adopted a subscription model. If we think back to the kinds of companies that benefit most from an inflationary environment, it's those that have got pricing power. Well, you have a lot more pricing power when you have a subscription business model. Because when, for example, Netflix decides to raise its price from $9.99 or $11.99 to $11 or to $12.50, well, that doesn't look like a lot of money to the end consumer, because the sticker shock is so much less, but it does tend to be cumulative. So when you think about it in those terms, it is the subscription-oriented businesses that will tend to benefit. And We know which ones those are. I've created a section in the chart library for subscription-oriented business models, and I continue to add to it. What was certainly in the news today was Sage Group, and it pulled back by more than it has done in at least a decade, if not 2 decades, because it's having difficulty employing its subscription model. Certainly, it's encountering some teething problems. But it was well off the low in here today, and the evolution of a subscription business model for a software company like this, or a customer relationship management type enterprise, is the logical course of action. If we, for example, look at Autodesk, that they've employed a subscription business model, but it took a while for them to get it going, and they also had a big pullback in early 2016 following the initiation of that, because it is long-term beneficial, but it tends to be volatile in the short term. So that is certainly one of the areas where we have seen a rotation into. Then you have the semiconductors sector, and semiconductors also have a certain degree of pricing power, not least because there is such incredible demand for them. We are in a period of time where the number of processors is going to multiply, that in an Internet of Things type environment, that there is going to be a processor and a router in just about, or let's just call it a web-enabled device in absolutely everything. The fact that you have innovation in batteries and in terms of Internet of Things means that at the ease with which web-enabled devices can be introduced into everyday items is falling all the time. And these are the kinds of things that are going to drive the bull market. That when you think about what is the long-term potential, where is it we're going to be in 20, 30 years from now? Well, we know where we're going to be because we know what the enabling technologies are going to be. That 5G is being rolled out, and that is going to massively increase the connectivity potential of the market. So that will be an enabling architecture for the Internet of Things. It will be an enabling architecture for autonomous vehicles, and for something of a hive mind in terms of traffic control. So we already have the almost the genesis of that in terms of the Waze app. I was enormously gratified to see that it worked in Japan. Obviously, they'd have considerably fewer users in Japan, but it worked beautifully. In fact, it was much easier to use than the sat nav in the rental car that we had, because the only way we could use that was through Mrs. Tracy being able to read Japanese, although not being able to speak it. Well, I think that that is the genesis of where we're going with the autonomous vehicle sector. Then you also have battery technology. Batteries are a revolutionary change in terms of energy, because they're an enabling technology. They allow people to be more inventive and more creative with how they decide to use energy. Then we have the evolution of superconductors. In just the last couple of months, MIT has come out with the view that they're going to be able to build a fusion reactor within the next decade, and it's going to cost them $300 million. And the reason that they can do that is because of innovation that has occurred in superconductors. That the size of the magnetic field, or the power of the magnetic field that they can create now with as a result of commercially driven superconductors has multiplied, and they think that they can do it much cheaper and more effectively than the ITER project that's being built with incredible delays and enormous expense in the south of France. I only mention it because this is one of at least 10, if not 20, different potential fusion reactors that are getting built around the world. One of the more important points about fusion is that it has been 30 years away for the better part of 100 years, whereas we don't have it yet, but the forecasts for how close it is have certainly been getting shorter. And with the barrier to entry being reduced by technological innovation, where you already have, there are other stories where Google has been able to reduce the amount of time that it takes to test the containment field for the containment parameters for plasma from a month to a few hours through the use of artificial intelligence. So fusion is one of the things that has been one of the greatest challenges for science for a century. And there is the possibility that we are a decade away from solving it. Now, in the event that that occurs, that alone would create a secular bull market. But again, this is an enabling technology. So we know that there are challenges in the short term, and we know that the medium-term bull market is mature. But when we think about what the long term is, that it isn't difficult at all to come up with the reasons behind a secular bull market. And I haven't spoken at all about healthcare and the innovation that's going on in terms of genetic sequencing and genetic editing. And that is progressing at lightning speed. So we know then that where the potential sources for outperformance are over the longer term. The big question, and it has been the big question for at least the last 5 years, is what are we going to do with all the debt? Well, the question is a pretty simple one to answer, because it's the classic answer that we've always had. We're going to inflate it away. And that, I think, is exactly what the USA is engaged in right now. That quantitative easing was designed to inflate the debt away, and it failed. So, if monetary stimulus didn't do it, now they're going for fiscal stimulus, and fiscal stimulus is going to get the job done, I suspect. Gold prices have got this saucering pattern that we haven't seen for an awfully long time. This is a very long-term range, and it has this beautiful rounding characteristic, which is consistent with accumulation. We know that there's accumulation underway because we have evidence of that in ETF holdings. ETF holdings are breaking out, and they've been trending higher for over a year already. Now, when we go back and look at the longer term chart of gold, the last time that we had a rounding characteristic in the gold market was all the way through from 1998 through to 2002. Then it broke out, and it rallied from 2002 through to 2011. It went from $300 to $1,900. And that was a phenomenal bull market, and it was punctuated by lengthy medium-term corrections. But it was a secular bull market driven by a significant number of factors, but certainly the evolution of the Chinese consumer market was a big one of those. And but I think what I'm particularly enthused about with gold right now is that the chart pattern looks almost identical to what we saw back in the early 2000s. We are at obviously a substantially higher price now than we were then. It's $1,000 higher than it was back in 2002. But if we do get an inflationary outcome, and it is looking increasingly likely that that is the case, that rather than simply prognosticating on that basis, but simply if we look at where the base formations are, then the logical conclusion is that when those base formations are completed, they will be vindication for a return to an inflationary environment. And I think that gold has been doing badly enough for long enough that what I see evidence of in terms of the commentary that I see from people that have been considered gold pundits for decades, that I see caution. I see people that have been conditioned not to expect a breakout because we have been ranging for such an incredibly long time. And it feels like a long time when breakouts have failed on repeated occasions for 5 years. So what this says to me is that ranges are explosions waiting to happen, and that the next big range that is likely to be completed on the upside is gold, and that that is likely to be one of the hedges against an inflationary outcome. And that would suggest that, considering how long it has been going sideways for, that it isn't at all, I think, over-enthusiastic to think that if it does break out, that over the course of the next few years we could see it retest its peak and potentially do more than that. Now, I usually start these broadcasts with the Dow Gold Ratio, but I think I will end it on the Dow Gold Ratio on this occasion. If we go back and look at the history of the ratio, it does not go up in a straight line. There are significant occasions along the way when gold tends to outperform the stock market, and we may be approaching one of those right now. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish a pleasant weekend to all of you. I'll certainly be meeting some of you in Melbourne next week, and that may affect the publication schedule for the site, but I will certainly endeavour to ensure that it is updated in a reasonably timely manner throughout the week. And I wish all the best to all of you.